This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Once just a radio show, but podcast listeners like you are part of the fastest growing segment of our audience. So thanks for downloading what you might call the Pocket Takeaway. Here's our daily show.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Huckenberry. Thank you so much for listening. Well, this hour, we're hearing about your extreme sporting adventures, whether you're a bungee jumper or a rock climber or just a parent of a young kid going too fast on a skateboard. What extreme activities have you participated in, and did the rewards outweigh the risks? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your story. But first, we begin with a story of bikes and brotherhood, of bars and crime, the lesser-known world of motorcycle clubs that gained national attention, of course, this week in Waco, Texas, when rival biker gangs broke out into terrible violence and gunfire in a shopping plaza. The confrontation left 9 people dead and 18 others wounded. 5 gangs were involved in the brawl, but the Cossacks and the Bandidos seem to have originated the dispute. 170 people are now facing charges from organized crime to assault to murder. Edward Winterhalder is an author, a bike culture expert, and a former bandito himself. And he says the crime that occurs in motorcycle clubs is less organized than you might think.
I know exactly what sparked this particular altercation. There's got to be a little bit of explanation to start with about the patch that the guys wear on their back of their vest. On the top rocker is usually the name of the organization. The center patch is typically the logo, the club's logo. And then the bottom rocker usually designates the geographic territory in which they live. In this particular case, the Bandidos for years, decades, have been one of the few clubs in Texas to wear a Texas bottom rocker. And they didn't, or haven't for a long time, allowed any other clubs to wear the Texas bottom rocker. And last year, the Cossacks decided that they were going to wear a Texas bottom rocker, and the Bandidos told them that wasn't going to happen, and the Cossacks told the Bandidos that they didn't care what they think, that they were going to do it anyway.
And this dispute over the bottom rocker on the backs of their leather vests wound up with 9 people dead.
Well, this has been building for about a year, maybe a little bit more. There had been minor skirmishes. There was a stabbing in Abilene or Odessa last year in March, I think, between the Bandidos and the Cossacks. And the bad blood has been brewing for quite a while.
Edward Winterhalder, you know, it's a little bit surprising to hear this level of violence over essentially logos on a jacket. There's a cliche, I'm afraid, that in criminal gangs, you know, blood is expensive. You don't resort to violence unless there's a lot of money at stake. And when I first heard about this, I assumed it was a drug dispute or something that had to do with money. And you're saying that's not the case.
No, absolutely not. And that's typically not what things are about in the motorcycle club world. The best analogy I can give you is going back to first grade when you were on the playground. There was a couple of bullies there, and they didn't get along very well, and they didn't play in the same spot on the playground. And if they did, there was usually a fight. And that's very similar to this situation. To add fuel to the fire is the fact that some of the guys in the clubs are methamphetamine addicts. They're unstable. You can't control them, and they really have no conception of what reality is. So when a couple of meth addicts from 2 different organizations meet that are disputing a bottom rocker, then you have an instantaneous fight. Because of the brotherhood and the camaraderie that's present in the motorcycle club world, very similar to what you'd find in a fraternity or in the military, then people stick up for their own. So if you see one of your brothers get stabbed, then you want to shoot the guy that stabbed your brother.
That also suggests, even though law enforcement is heavily involved now and the national media is talking about this, that this violent confrontation might not be over.
I think it's over temporarily, but in the future the two clubs will run into each other again in different places, and it will continue is my guess. What I expect to see happen is the federal law enforcement authorities, this event will now cause them to microscopically examine certain clubs in the United States, and Department of Justice, FBI, ATF, and an assortment of other agencies will probably do whatever they can, use whatever tool they have in their tool bag to prevent this kind of thing from happening again.
Well, Edward Winterhalter, what was it like for you when you were a member of the Bandidos? You're still here, so clearly you didn't wind up in the same fate as nine of the other bikers from the Bandidos and the Cossacks in Texas. What was it like for you?
For me, I was on the other side of the coin. And again, some background, 60 to 70% of the guys that are in motorcycle clubs are regular guys. They have jobs, families, kids. They go to work each day. The only thing they're guilty of is having too much fun on the weekends. So for me, that's the side of the club that I was in on. I ran a multi-million-dollar construction management company while I was a Bandido. I was a single dad with custody. So each day for me, I would get up at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, get her off to daycare and school, and go off to work. Just about everybody in my chapter was the same way. You know, there are some guys present that commit crimes, but typically they don't brag about it. It's not like the mafia where they have to report to the boss and give him a piece of the money. We actually had a meth guy in our chapter we didn't know anything about until he got busted for selling meth. Had no idea.
So these are not fundamentally criminal gangs that ride motorcycles, in other words?
No, it's more disorganized crime than it is organized. And the motorcycle clubs are very forgiving, so they accept people for who they are and what they are. I think you'll see mass federal indictments of these two organizations and a bunch more. And I think that they will wipe out the leadership of the club, forcing it to take a different path.
Edward Winterhalter, former Bandido Motorcycle Club member. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, for more on the business and the scale of these motorcycle clubs, we turn now to Charles Falco. He's author of Vagos, Mongols, and Outlaws, My Infiltration of America's Deadliest Biker Gangs. Charles, welcome.
Thank you, Todd.
You spent a career contracting with law enforcement, infiltrating biker gangs like the Bandidos. Well, you just heard Edward Winterhalter there. He says that law enforcement wants people to believe that motorcycle clubs are all criminals, basically, but that these are not fundamentally criminal enterprises in reality, but the majority are regular guys with jobs and families. Is that your experience?
No. I mean, I agreed with 90% of what he said, except for the part where you have innocent members of these motorcycle gangs. There's a big difference between motorcycle clubs and motorcycle gangs. The Bandidos are a motorcycle gang. The Cossacks are a motorcycle gang. If you're in one of these gangs, even if you have a regular job, a family, a wife, and kids, you still know that you have to be willing to kill, maim, seriously hurt, or perpetrate other acts of violence to protect your territory. So all members, when they go through the prospecting period, know that they have to be willing to do anything to back up their brothers, their territory, and their colors, just like the Crips, the Bloods, MS-13, or any of the other street gangs. So they mimic those. And I wouldn't say they're unorganized. I'd say they're unorganized in crimes like, you know, drug dealing and some of the other things you think about when you think about organized crime organizations. But when it comes to war and violence and fighting over their territory, they're 100 times more sophisticated than other street gangs. They have a military style structure, and they're just very sophisticated at warring with each other. They'll keep files, they'll do counter surveillance and surveillance against enemy combatants or enemy biker gangs. So they'll know where they live, where they work, what time they go to work, you know, where they hang out, who their girlfriends are, who their wife and family are. So they're very sophisticated when it comes to war. When committing other criminal acts, they are not as organized.
Okay, so let's leave aside then, of course, the thousands of people who are in motorcycle clubs because they like to ride on the weekends. Those apparently are not much of a concern. How many people would you estimate, how many gangs are we talking about across the United States that are a serious threat, a serious criminal enterprise?
There's probably, you know, 25 to 45 motorcycle gangs. There's about 10 big ones, and then the rest are more small, minor motorcycle gangs. Probably, if I had to estimate total membership, somewhere between 5,000 and 8,000. And those are your hardcore motorcycle gang members. And then you have, you know, 500,000 other active bikers that have nothing to do with that world. If you want to be a 9-to-5 guy who just likes to ride and party and stuff like that, you don't become part of an outlaw motorcycle gang. You know, when you join them, that you're bullies of that world, that you have to participate in violence to protect your territory.
Edward Winterhalter told us to expect a lot of federal law enforcement micromanagement of gangs now. And that reminded me of you and the kind of undercover infiltration work that you did. Do you expect that? Do you expect ATF or the FBI or whoever it is to get more Charles Falcos into these gangs to try to prevent the kind of violence that now all of a sudden we're all talking about?
Oh, yes. I think you'll see a big jump in them prosecuting these biker gangs. I think you'll see legislation change in some of these states. I wouldn't be surprised if you see some of these states make it harder for gang members to get concealed weapons permits, which I think is part of the problem of why there were so many deaths in this shootout in Texas, is that these biker gangs in states where you're allowed to have concealed weapons, the leadership has ordered members to get a concealed weapons permit if they're not felons. That way they're always armed to protect themselves from other biker gangs and to be proactive in incidents like this one that happened on Sunday.
And at the same time, this incident on Sunday, as we just heard, you know, doesn't appear to be about drug turf or criminal activities. It was a dispute over colors and rockers on jackets. And that sounds like that kind of thing is really hard to prevent.
Yeah, and it's really crazy, because if you look at biker gangs throughout the rest of the world, they're fighting for territory, but drug territory or prostitution territory, something that has more of an evil, logical sense to it. But these guys, and especially in the United States, they just fight over territory just to fight. We just call them, you know, when I was infiltrating the outlaws, you know, they just said we're men of war. Mm-hmm. And that's what they like to do.
Charles Falco is author of Vagos, Mongols, and Outlaws, My Infiltration of America's Deadliest Biker Gangs. Charles Falco, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. If you're not a U.S. citizen and you have information that leads to the capture or killing of a terrorist overseas, you could be eligible for up to $20 million. And that's because of the State Department's Rewards for Justice program. That program was created by Congress back in 1984 after the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut to combat international terrorism. Well, in Seymour Hersh's report on the killing of Osama bin Laden, that controversial report of just a couple of weeks ago, it was a former Pakistani intelligence officer who disclosed bin Laden's location to the CIA, receiving a $25 million bounty and a job at the CIA in return. That's according to Seymour Hersh's controversial report. But are bounties effective? Does distrust of the United States stop possible informants from coming forward? Fred Burton is vice president of intelligence for Stratfor, and during his tenure with the State Department back in the 80s and 90s, he was a counterterror agent and part of the team that created the very first Rewards for Justice program. And Fred Burton, back at the time, just three of you in a small office at State, is that right?
That's correct, Todd. It's hard to believe today, but there was only three of us that first started this program.
Well, let's begin maybe with the most important question of the day. What do you know, or at least what would you care to speculate about whether or not the path that led to Osama bin Laden was the result of a $25 million payoff from this program that you helped to create?
You raise an interesting question, Todd, because U.S. government agencies don't necessarily have to go to the rewards program to claim that bounty per se. So for bin Laden, the CIA could have paid a reward themselves without submitting that to the interagency committee that decides who justifies a reward. Having said that, when you look at the bin Laden case, you have to go back in time and think about the previous rewards we have put into place that has led to the capture and or the killing of terrorists overseas. Let me give you, for example, back on my watch, we paid an informant through the Rewards for Justice program over $1 million to help us capture Ramzi Yousef, the mastermind of the first World Trade Center bombing. And if you fast forward over the years, the largest single reward that I'm aware of was a $30 million bounty was paid to an informant by the Rewards for Justice program to lead to the capture of Saddam Hussein's son.
So, Fred Burton, what are the limitations of this program? You know, on the one hand, you think the one thing that ties the world together is money, cold hard cash, and a lot of it. I mean, $25 million is a lot of money in any culture, in any which way you slice it. On the other hand, fighters, informants for a movement like Islamic State that is so very ideological and believes itself to have a higher spiritual calling may not be for sale.
Well, I can speak firsthand to the limitations we had on my watch. At times, we would not get a lot of international cooperation, meaning many countries do not want the United States in there offering the Reward for Justice program based on sovereignty issues. One of the other aspects of the program are ways to expedite visa entry into the United States for that person as well as for their family. So there are other levers you can push or to sweeten the pot to get someone to come forward to try to help you. But at the end of the day, it has been my experience that most people have their price and you just have to press that button. The more challenging aspect, Todd, is to find that person that has that granular intelligence that really can give you the specific whereabouts, exact place and time for that terrorist to be apprehended.
And what a challenge that is. Take us inside this world a little bit. Let's invent a little bit of a scenario here, which probably isn't unrealistic. An Islamic State commander in Iraq, somebody the United States wants to apprehend or kill, but obviously Islamic State isn't going to put a U.S. advertisement for a reward on its airways. The Iraqi government may not put it on its radio station either. So what is a way that the United States can reach somebody in the neighborhood to let them know that there's $20 million available if they help us apprehend that Islamic State commander that we're talking about?
The agents will utilize reward posters. They will use matchbooks with pictures of the person of interest on the matchbooks and hope that they get into all the little tea shops and cafes. They will also utilize social media because all of these groups today are very active on Twitter and Facebook. I know historically we actually did public service announcements utilizing various Hollywood movie actors to help us promote the message to get the word out.
So, Fred Burton, at this point, if you can make a guess, what percentage, what ratio of American reward money, bounty money, is paid through Rewards for Justice in this overt way versus the amount that is paid completely in secret by clandestine agents, either through the CIA or some other branch in a duffel bag full of cash that's off the books and is just paid in a way that's a lot more secret?
I would place that figure, again, and this is a guess on my part today, would be at about a 40-60%, meaning 40% are paid through the Rewards for Justice program versus 60% being paid for operational assets, ongoing informants that are being worked either by the State Department, the CIA, or the FBI. Remember, although most people know it as a capture of a terrorist program, the real intent by Congress in putting this together was to prevent future acts of terrorism. So I know we paid a reward once in Southeast Asia to an informant that prevented a horrific airport-style attack on a ticket counter of U.S. flag carriers in Southeast Asia. So what you're really after is that informant that has actionable intelligence to help you prevent an attack from taking place.
Fred Burton, Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
On Monday, European foreign ministers agreed to use a naval force to help stop human trafficking across the Mediterranean from North Africa. And this was a significant step to stem the flood of migrants that has drawn the world's attention in recent weeks there. But there is no such help for another group of migrants who are in dire conditions in the Bay of Bengal off the coast of Thailand. The Rohingya are a Muslim ethnic group that has long been persecuted in Myanmar or Burma. They've lacked basic rights there. In the last 3 years, more than 120,000 Rohingyas have boarded ships to flee abroad. That's according to the UN Refugee Agency. And now thousands are stranded at sea in the Bay of Bengal, adrift in disabled ships. And their situation is an emergency. Joining me now from Satun, Thailand, near the Thai-Malaysia border, is Jonathan Head. He's BBC Southeast Asia correspondent. Jonathan, welcome.
Good to talk to you.
First, who are the Rohingya people and why are they fleeing Myanmar?
They're a minority that have lived close to the border with Bangladesh for many years. There's long been tension between them and the Buddhist population of Rakhine State. This is the westernmost state in Burma or Myanmar. It's historic. They've also been regarded by recent governments, Burmese governments, as unwanted settlers. They've not been given citizenship. And in fact, they are currently, after some sectarian violence 3 years ago, segregated in almost apartheid-like conditions, confined to squalid camps, not allowed to move around, not allowed to travel without permission. And it's those conditions that are driving them to seek a better life elsewhere. And to make these perilous journeys across the Bay of Bengal to try to get mostly to Malaysia, a fellow Muslim country where some of them have already settled and where they think they can get jobs.
And this terrible situation, as you mentioned, has been going on for several years, in addition to the human trafficking that's cropped up around it to make money. So why at this point does it appear that there are as many as 8,000 Rohingyas stranded at sea?
Well, what's happened is, after a great deal of urging, the Thai government has decided to move against the trafficking networks. It's something they've been reluctant to do. There are some very powerful, wealthy people in Thailand with good connections to politicians who run this business. And to give you an idea about how profitable it is, the traffickers buy people by the boatload from Burma or from Bangladesh. So they might buy a boatload of 300 to 400 people for perhaps $20,000 or $30,000. But they then hold them for ransom and demand $2,000 to $3,000 per person from their families. Now, if you've got 300 or 400 people and you can even get half their families to pay that, this is a hugely profitable business. And last year, the United States downgraded Thailand to the lowest possible level on its annual trafficking in persons report, a big humiliation for Thailand that they'd resisted for years. Then earlier this year, the media uncovered mass graves in some of the camps where they hold these migrants, where they hold them for ransom and terribly mistreat those who can't pay. That's basically forced the Thais to shut the trafficking networks down. That's blocked the route for people who left Burma or Bangladesh earlier this year and hoping to get to Malaysia. They would normally have been taken by the traffickers over land. Because of this crackdown, they can't land and they've been sitting out at sea, or their brokers have, not daring to land, running out of food, running out of water. In some cases, their crews simply abandoned them. And at least one case appear to have disabled the engine. And that's why their condition is so critical.
Yes, but this suggests that the crackdown happened so suddenly that a smuggling ship that would have left days or a week or two ago from Myanmar, from wherever it launched, all of a sudden had no place to land.
That's exactly right. I mean, it wasn't planned. I'm afraid this government in Thailand, it's a military government, has generally been very reactive. And the authorities knew about these terrible camps, and they're almost like death camps. I met policemen in Thailand who knew about them and wanted to stop them, but just there was no will at the top level. Now, this embarrassment with these mass graves has suddenly forced them to act, but it is very sudden, and it does leave these people stranded. And I think that's the point that's being made now to the government here and to neighboring governments, that Yes, it's a big dilemma what you do with waves of migrants coming. You don't want to open your doors to potentially tens of thousands of people. But these particular groups who are at sea now, we're talking probably 6,000 to 7,000, are in danger of losing their lives. I mean, we found a boat last week. I'm very lucky to find one at all. They're very hard to find. And we're able to approach it. These people have been at sea for 3 months. They were in terrible, terrible conditions. Some of them were half starved, their ribs poking through. They were quite desperate. And when you've got a situation like that, clearly there's an urgent need to get them to land and give them treatment. And you can deal with the issue about migration and who takes responsibility for them later.
Is there a Navy in the area and indeed a government that's willing to step up in this emergency?
Sadly not. All three governments, that's Indonesia, Malaysia and Thailand, are sticking to a hardline stand where they'll give them food and water, they'll help fix their engines, then they push them out of their own territorial seas. They basically say they can't land. And there's a lot of finger-pointing going on as well, I should say. The government's here pointing back at the Burmese government and saying, well, this is all you're doing. If you treated your Rohingya minority properly, then we wouldn't have this great flood of people. But of course, the blame must be spread around. Thailand and Malaysia have tolerated the trafficking business for many, many years, and it's become so profitable, it's sucking in a great many more people this year than it has in previous years. They're induced, really, to come along with this promise eventually of a better life in Malaysia.
Let's take a step back just for a moment, though, Jonathan Head. The world, including the United States, has been busy for the last couple of years celebrating the political opening up of Burma, of Myanmar, new government, new democratic processes there. This cuts directly against that.
Yes, it does. And it's not the only concern about Burma or Myanmar. I mean, the fact that there was an opening in this country that had sealed itself off and was ruled by such an inward-looking and really horribly repressive government was undoubtedly a cause for hope. But the fact is, when you've had that kind of military rule for so long, we're talking 50 years of isolation, of dreadful impoverishment, of the military manipulating different ethnic groups, and there are so many in Burma, against each other, it's inevitable you'll get a lot of problems.
There are at least 8,000 ethnic Rohingyas from Myanmar stranded at sea in Southeast Asia in need of food and water as countries around the area, including Thailand and Malaysia and Indonesia and Myanmar, simply dither. Jonathan Head, BBC Southeast Asia correspondent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. And over the weekend, two extreme athletes named Dean Potter and Graham Hunt died while attempting to base jump in Yosemite National Park. Now, that's the same park where Carl Banisch, the father of base jumping, is credited with launching the sport back in the 1970s. And like Potter and Hunt today, Banisch died doing what he loved.
We had agreed that it was suicidal. You just had this feeling of doom. Nobody could survive that jump. Carl thought that he could get away with it, but the mountain had other ideas.
Banisch's story of pioneering base jumping, of creating innovations in filmmaking, and of his love for his wife and fellow jumper Jean Banisch, it's all told in the new film Sunshine Superman. The film is in theaters this Friday. It's a remarkable film about a remarkable and magnetic person. Jean Banisch sat down with me last week to talk about her husband's love of jumping and the filming of his many, many descents.
Carl loved making films. He wanted to film free fall to find out why people's cheeks flapped in the air. And so he developed slow motion methods of bringing the footage back to the studio and looking at it and actually seeing what he wanted to discover. And he became a very advanced skydiver. And there was a time in the 70s when people were around him were looking also for new challenges, new things to do in skydiving. And there were a lot of advanced jumpers, and they had the bug. They wanted to find something new, and they found El Capitan, and they went and jumped off of it, and Carl filmed it, and that was the beginning of modern base jumping.
Well, when Carl and all of his friends were jumping off of El Capitan, it was not only, I guess, a challenge to nature, but also to authority. I mean, there were park rangers, there was the federal government, it was illegal, dangerous. They had a lot more than just getting the chute open to worry about. They were, I guess, outlaws.
It was just a brand new activity. And with anything that was this new, people didn't understand that it could be done. So we had to introduce them to the fact that, number one, it could be done. And then when somebody comes and asks you for a permit, they don't think that you're asking for something that just is flat out impossible. And it worked out quite well in the long run. In the film, you see the chief ranger there, and we had a very good rapport with him.
Well, it's clear you had a good rapport with him because that chief ranger who early on was responsible for busting Carl Banish, you know, it's clear in the film he loved him.
Everybody loved Carl. Carl was a very, very likable person. And everybody took away a special experience of him that enhanced their lives.
Well, the film is remarkable not only for the kind of person that it portrays in Carl Banish and yourself, Gene Banish, but also the amazing footage that you have, whether it's outtakes or free falls, cameras attached to helmets in those early years. I'm thinking, God, who needs a GoPro? Who needs it? You know, you guys had this figured out back when the technology was, you know, fairly rudimentary.
I've never used a GoPro. We used gun cameras. And that's the closest we ever got to guns. So it's kind of funny that we would be using things that were surplus military from World War II. And the weight that we would carry on our heads on average was, well, mine for a dual-mounted camera, still and movie, was 12.5 pounds. And then Carl's was upward of about 15. It was a lot of weight. You had to really know what you're doing, be very careful in opening, and be always constantly aware not only of the safety factors, but also where the sun was, where the angles were, who you were looking at, were they framed properly? So there was a lot to consider in addition to the regular jumping needs.
Everybody in the film, Gene Banish, says in a lot of different ways that when you and Carl got together back then when you first met him, that you were the very last person they would ever expect to jump off of a cliff. You looked like a librarian. You were kind of quiet, not the stereotypical cliched base jumper or skydiver.
I think Carl and I were preparing ourselves for each other, much like everybody does in life, but they don't realize it. And when we got together, it was very right. It happened very quickly for us. And I think one of the things that Carl really liked was the fact that I actually had met him when he was first showing his final film poem to a mutual group of friends. And then the summer went past and I started skydiving on my own. And I came back and called him up to try to find a way to the local drop zone. So it was very natural for both of us.
And the question has to be asked because a lot of people from this time may remember this. Almost immediately after Carl's death in 1984 in a jump gone wrong, you went right back up there. You jumped yourself almost immediately. Why did you do that and what example were you trying to set?
Well, there was another young man, as the film shows, who had arrived there to make a jump. And it was very clear that it would not look very good if he were to do that alone so soon thereafter. And I needed to go up. I needed to look at the site that Carl had the troubles from and see if we could figure out why. And it's always better to do it with somebody. So we went up together and did both things together. It made a lot of sense.
But, you know, one thing that's inescapable here is that it destroys the idea of skydiving people, base jumpers, as
adrenaline junkies. I mean, that's the cliche you go to right away. Somebody who jumps out of a plane or off a bridge, they're just an adrenaline junkie. They can't be happy unless they get that rush. That's really not what the film was about, and I don't think that's what Carl was about.
You're right. That's not what it was about. We weren't adrenaline junkies. We weren't daredevils. We weren't crazy. We were simply enjoying an experience that was broadening, enjoying an experience of self-discovery. And this happened to be our chosen method. And it was a very condensed way, a very, very accelerated way to learn. And that's one reason we liked to share with people, because we had learned certain things so in a unique way that was worthy of sharing.
Jean Banish, wife of Carl, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Sunshine Superman tells the story of Carl Banish, the father of base jumping, and it's in theaters this Friday. And here's something to take with you today, a potential breakthrough in the case of Adnan Syed, the subject of the now famous podcast Serial. This week, the Maryland Court of Special Appeals granted Syed a new evidentiary hearing that will allow for one key witness, Asia McClain, to take the stand. Now, if you remember from the podcast, Asia McClain might have a key alibi for Adnan. She says she saw him in the school library at the time that Haymin Lee was murdered. Could be a breakthrough. That's all for today. You can ask me anything on Twitter at Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick in all of the rest of this week for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing users with tools to create websites for small business or their own personal brand. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.